come to order. It's 8:32 a.m. on March 1st, 2016. We have members present, Senator Huggins, Vice Chair Coghill, and myself, Stoltz. We have a quorum to do business, trying to get through as much as we can today. First up, we'll bring up the Senate President's bill, bring it up on this first day of March, trying to make sure we can get it before we get to the actual month of awareness, of which all 12 months are, actually. So, welcome. The special designated month of in heightened awareness is what we call it, right?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
This Senate Concurrent Resolution 20 proclaims April 2016 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. It's part of a national campaign to raise the awareness of sexual assault and educate communities on how to prevent sexual violence. You know, I'm sure you're going, we've heard this before, and we have. We bring this forward every year. But as you know, the sexual assault statistics nationwide and in Alaska are staggering. They're even worse here in Alaska. In fact, research suggests that 2.5 times the national rate. The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault conducts an annual victimization survey, and they'll speak to some of those statistics in more depth. Mr. Chairman, sexual violence is preventable. It's a social, public health, criminal justice, human rights issue. This year, 2016 Sexual Assault Awareness Month campaign focuses on building blocks of prevention by communicating how individuals, communities, and the private sector can take action to promote safety, respect, and equality. We hope that Senate Concurrent Resolution 20 will help to broaden and strengthen that effort across the state. That concludes my brief comments, Mr. Chairman. Certainly there's folks here that can speak more on this topic. The Executive Director of the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Awareness is also here. And so with that, I'll conclude my comments.
You had us at good morning.
I'm sorry?
You had us at good morning there.
Yes, thank you.
Were there any other
comments? No, I'll ask my trusting.
It's this committee is very familiar with the issue, and so it's one of your annual resolutions you do. But again, I know it's a 12-month, not just a one-month deal. But this is a part of a national campaign. I appreciated you putting that on a record, and we'll go ahead and take public testimony if there's no questions. So, try to speed this along the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody wishing to testify on the bill? Brevity is our best friend here when we have a big schedule.
Good morning, Senator Stoltz, members of the committee. My name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for hearing the resolution today and wanting to pass it speedily along. I would just like to say it's not often in this very difficult business that we get to share some positive news, and I'd just like to put that briefly on the record. In 2010, the Alaska Victimization Survey showed that 58 out of every 100 Alaska women had suffered intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both over the course of their lifetime. In 2015, 5 years after, we resurveyed, and the news is encouraging. It's still too high, it's still horrible, but now it is down to 50 out of every 100 women have suffered these crimes. Particular to sexual assault, it has decreased by 33%. And I would just like to say what that means. 3,072 fewer victims in 2015 than in 2010. So we still have a long way to go. We appreciate your support. I'm available for questions. But I did want to say that there is hope, and there are communities across our state that are working very diligently to end sexual violence in our state. They're doing such with programs like Green Dot, Coaching Boys into Men, Girls on the Run, the Fourth R. They're looking within themselves as communities to find their strengths and resiliencies to be able to stand up and say no more, and we support those efforts.
I have one question, and it's been a concern to me. There was a lot of rumor and titter about how much cover-up there was, even 30, trying to think, when I first entered the UAF campus in 1979 until my graduation in the early 80s, about the prevalence of sexual assault and domestic violence and stalking and just basically violence against women that was for public relations matters covered up by the university system, and now, well, 35 years later, almost 30, I'm trying to think when I graduated in 1984, there's still that issue, and it's sending shockwaves through. What do you have any thoughts about that, and ways? I don't expect you, from your past history, that we should help women protect themselves, but how can we as a system provide, I think sunlight is the best best source. And what are your comments on the university system, and how confident should a young woman or their parents feel about sending them there?
Senator Stoltz, one of the things that we've started to do in offering our services to assist the university is working with their Title IX coordinators. Last fall, we sent them to a national conference where the very issue of sexual assault on university campuses was addressed. We've also been working with Senator Sullivan at the congressional area to look at ways in which we can strengthen supports for women on campus who want to report sexual assaults. We've been working with the university in Fairbanks to institute Green Dot and to look at ways in which people can work together to create safety for women there. We realize it's an issue. It's on our May calendar to be able to receive more information from the university, and we're very open to finding ways to work with them to support that.
What? There's been a lot of talk, and it's been since I was a student there, and it was certainly it was just kind of a quiet buzz, and kind of a disguised, systemically disguised problem at the university, and I haven't seen it. It almost seems in many ways gotten worse, and it's had spill out. I mean, is this really going to be solved by another conference, or what systemic things do you see? This is right in our face right now, even more so. The spill out has been pretty obvious in some of the restructuring in universities.
Senator Stoltz, another opportunity that we've suggested to the university and would be supportive of working with them with is through the Office of Violence Against Women. There are grants to address sexual assault on university campuses. Offer our services in that area as well.
See why a young woman might risk expulsion to have a gun to protect herself, I expect it.
Senator Stoltz, that would be up to the individual.
That's progress. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Moore? I appreciate at least, I think we have a lot deeper to delve into the university and on there, and it has been a systemic concern. Back from when I was a student, my uncles were students, they said it was the same way, and it's the culture of a university structure, want to protect its image, and not if you're worried about recruitment and trying to entice Alaskans to stay, you don't want to tell your dirty secrets, but how do you protect people if you don't have awareness? Mm-hmm. That's rhetorical. Senator Coghill.
Two things, and thank you, Lori. I think probably because people are watching us, there's two things I'd like for you to bring up. One, what a Title IX counselor is, and then secondly, if somebody in the university doesn't know where to go, just give us a kind of the primer on, if you feel under pressure, where do you go?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, Title IX is a title and federal statute for protections in different areas for for students. I think most people associate it with equity in sports programming, but it's much broader than that, and particularly in this instance relates to sexual assault and addressing it equitably on campuses. If anyone is concerned about sexual assault or they've been sexually assaulted, they are welcome to go to any of the funded programs in Fairbanks. It would be the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living. In Anchorage, it would be Standing Together Against Rape or Awake. Here in Juneau, it would be the Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies. For the college campuses throughout the state, communities such as Bethel, there's Tundra Women's Coalition. So people can go onto our website to find a list of those service communities or on the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault's website to find. They're mostly 800 numbers, so it doesn't cost to call. It's a 24-hour service. You can talk to someone there who can work through your options and give you support as you're deciding how best for you to carry forward.
I guess there was a glaring omission. You didn't say call campus security. You didn't say call the dean's office, make an appointment. You didn't. I'll interpret that as I just didn't hear it. So thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Morton? And I'd like to recognize that Senator Wilikowski joined us. I don't like to announce people during somebody's testimony there, so welcome. Thank you. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on this legislation? Please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I am only 2 weeks here in my job, and so very honored to be serving the fine people of Alaska. I would like to say for the record that we appreciate that this resolution was heard, and thank you for your willingness to do that and for your commitment. Thank you very much for your commitment to all the prevention work that is ongoing in the state. And we, the network, have submitted a letter of support and a letter of gratitude for this resolution. Laurie has already answered a lot of questions. I also am open to answering any questions you may have, and certainly do appreciate this opportunity.
Senator Coghill.
One of the issues that we struggle with in Alaska is when somebody gets into a relationship and then ends up in the sex trade under duress. And I think one of the struggles they have is the duress then becomes deadly in many cases. We've tried to address it from a legal perspective on penalties and everything, but what do you see from, you know, awareness to give young ladies warnings of risky relationships, things like that, that we need to know from kind of the working level, what's going on, you know, in the communities?
I thank you for the question. Through the chair, I would like to respond. In those types of situations, I think one of the most important elements is that there's a clear awareness. One is to make sure that law enforcement is fully aware of what the legal codes are and to make sure that people understand what would constitute someone being trafficked or someone being exploited in that way. The second part of the awareness is to ensure, and I do believe that our member programs are open and are prepared to receive people. But the most important thing is to make sure that we're getting the message out. And so that's going through some of our local partners to look at what are high-risk kinds of situations and how do we make sure that people are aware. So some of that is also about talking to employers and to make sure that people are following the regulations.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
If I could, I think maybe as April comes around that we might, I would suggest to you that in Alaska we have both the federal government and the state government working on on people who are trafficking in children and child pornography. We might want to get a report to kind of kick off the month of April just to show that that is actually happening in Alaska at a much greater level than any of us understand. And it's but it's a gruesome thing, but there's children today who are without a voice, today, who are being misused. And I think we need to bring that to light.
Thank you very much. That's a fine suggestion. Thank you.
Don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Ms. Lowry, and your letter of February 29th is in the members' folders. Thank you. Are there any other members of the public that wish to testify? Going once. We'll go ahead and close public testimony. Who wants over? Senator Coghill, would you like the honor?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move the Senate concurrent resolution number 20 from committee with individual recommendations, and I think there's a no fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, we'll just take a brief at ease while we sign the report, and we'll get ready for the reviews of appointees. Back to order. It's 8:49 after the brief recess. We're going to take up the governor's appointees to public offices commission, the state personnel board, and the state commission on human rights. We'll take up Mr. Temple first. He's appointed to the public office commission for the seat public restricted, and it's a party designated. And he'll tell us about himself. You're calling in from the interior, I believe.
Yes, sir. I am here.
Welcome. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and give us an introduction of yourself and your yearning to be a member of this commission and all it entails.
Yes, sir.
Your willingness, I guess. You may have been drafted. I don't know.
Sure. Yes, sir. My name is Thomas Temple. I'm an attorney in Fairbanks, Alaska. I work with Bill Satterberg and his law firm. I've lived in Alaska for approximately 11 years, a little less than 11 years. And, I'm sorry, I guess it would be actually more like 15 years. And I've served on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Planning Commission. I currently serve on the Fairbanks City Public Safety Commission and believe in public service, and I would like the opportunity to serve on APOC and serve in that capacity.
And Mr. Temple, how did you gain membership on those? Who appointed you?
The Borough Planning Commission was appointed by the borough mayor, and the City of Fairbanks Commission was by the city mayor.
And did they have names when they appointed you?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
The mayor, who were the mayors that appointed you?
The borough mayor who appointed me, I believe, was originally either Jim Whitaker or Luke Hopkins. This was back in 2005. The city mayor who originally appointed me was Mr. Cleworth, and I recently renewed for another term, and my renewal was by Mayor Eberhardt.
Thank you very much. And go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to make some notes here. Please go ahead.
I'm not sure I have anything else to specifically add about myself, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Temple. I guess maybe your interest and understanding of the Public Offices Commission, that would probably be good to think
yes,
with
sir.
You.
Well, I understand that its purpose is to encourage the public confidence in our public officials, elected and appointed officials, and the way they do that is administering the disclosure statutes and then compiling and publishing the data that has to do with campaigning and public offices and lobbyists, and serves as a quasi-judicial panel from time to time, as well as an advisory status to how the office of the APOC might be more efficient or better meet its goal.
You're a,
I find it to be an interesting position.
The what do you excuse me? What do you role view the role as your most important interaction with candidates and elected officials? Is it educational? Is it enforcement? What's the
Well, I imagine the goal of the commission is more enforcement or a quasi-judicial panel. I think it's the practice of staff to do the education. I'm not sure as a member of the actual commission would have much opportunity to educate, but more or less to serve as the arbiters of those who may not have properly disclosed things, and that's how I understand it.
And just one last question before I turn you over to Senator Huggins, who has a question. You're a designated seat because of a party membership. How do you view your role and responsibility as you're a designated seat?
Yes, sir. I'm not a, quite frankly, particularly political person, and I understand the seats are designated in some cases by party affiliation, but I just see my role as someone who wants to be fair, someone who wants to encourage confidence in our public officials in a world that is increasingly cynical towards government and public officials and public service, and anything I can do to make that process more transparent, efficient, I'm happy to do so.
That's how a lot of us operate. Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Temple, Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla. You know, if most of my neighbors would not know that the Alaska Public Office Commission even exists. So, were you somebody come and ask you about being on this, or you volunteered, or is it your lifelong dream?
No, sir, it's certainly not a lifelong dream. How I came to be before you today is my boss, Bill Satterberg, said there would be an opening coming up some months ago this spring and wanted to know if he was interested, that it's they preferred an attorney in the position. Mr. Satterberg wasn't interested and said, well, I have an attorney who works with me who might be. And when I heard there was an opening, I thought it would be another interesting and rewarding way to serve the public, and so I expressed my interest.
Yep. And you, when you say your boss, Mr. Satterberg, that he is part of the law firm, is it?
Yes, sir. He owns the law firm. I work for him, and have for approximately 11 years.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Mr. Temple? this is one of those situations. Usually say we hope to see you somewhere down the road, but this is a case where I really don't. But you're replacing Mr. Kirk's seat, is that correct?
Well, yes, sir, his seat, although he served as chairman, and I do not anticipate being a chairman anytime soon, perhaps in the future when I learn and could do a competent job if asked to do that. But I'm certainly not stepping into a chair position, but I understand that his seat is the one being vacated.
I really don't have any other questions. We're not trying to do dental work if there's no cavities. So I'll ask if, thank you, Mr. Temple, if you just stand by for a minute. We'll see if there's any public testimony. Is there anybody wishing to comment or testify on this appointment? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony and we will thank you for being here this morning and answering some questions. This is not supposed to be an inquisition. I think most of us hadn't heard of you, and we got at least a brief exchange. So we're further ahead in knowing who you are than we were. So we appreciate you being available this morning, Mr. Temple. And at the end of the hearing, we'll move forward all the board names onto the floor for a yet to be determined date for the joint session confirmation. So, with that, we thank you for your time, sir. Next, I go to Dr. Keith Hamilton, the governor's appointee to the State Personnel Board. This is a reappointment to a continuing term. Dr. Hamilton.
Good morning. From Slobodna.
Good morning. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and you have a little description of what you've done on the Personnel Board, and tell us what why you want to continue serving on that, or you're willing to continue serving.
Thank you. I'm a 15-year Alaskan. My family and I moved here from Colorado to start Alaska Christian College here in Soldotna, where I've been the president since then, and I have a privilege of serving on a few other state boards as well, Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education and the State Education Board. Began 6 years ago with personnel, however, with the former governor appointing me through boards and commissions. It's been very interesting to come at the end of prior Governor Palin's time here in our state, and there was a lot of issues related to ethics in the executive branch, and we were a part of the very tail end of that whole process, but understand the importance of integrity and the personnel in our state and executive branch, as well as helping to formulate policy throughout the state when it comes to issues related to state employees. And I'm one of three people appointed to that board, and they asked me if I would consider serving another full term, and I said absolutely.
Thank you. During your first term, what did you find the challenges, opportunities, or surprises of serving on this? Actually, not well-known, but pretty critical state board.
Yeah, it is more critical, I think, than people understand. I was surprised to being put on a television camera at one point through the process. I think we were kind of a quiet group back in the room with the three of us, clamoring for just making everything in the state run smoothly when it comes to personnel issues and things. That was a surprise. Also, second thing I would say is the joy of, since it really began full force 6 years ago, that we really haven't had any issues come forward to us from the executive branch that causes any undue concern for our state. There seems to be people of integrity serving in those higher offices.
So, thank you. Dr. Hamilton, you are charged with basically enforcing the provisions of the Executive Ethics Act, is that correct?
That's correct. It's one of our responsibilities.
Is it is one of your responsibilities making sure that there's not campaign activity within an administration? Not just this one, any other administration that you've overseen?
You know, I have not had any of that come up or occur during my tenure there. I am not sure if that is one of our areas of oversight and responsibility.
Would you consider conducting campaign activity with state employees as a ethics abridgment?
Yes, I would.
Okay. So it would probably be under your purview then.
I'm not sure if state statute puts us underneath that, but I would sure like to know.
Okay. Do you think it's appropriate for state employees to aid in collecting campaign contributions, even indirectly for political active entities?
If it's on their own personal time, as a citizen of the state of Alaska, they should be able to do what they wish to do.
As
outside of the time of their role in their job.
As a state employee using state equipment?
That would not be possible, no.
Do you think collecting employee deductions that also go to campaign activities is perhaps aiding using state funds for campaign activities?
The person is able to deduct from their paycheck whatever is legally available to them. And if that is one of the parts of their paycheck they're able to deduct legally through our state policies and laws, and they should be able to do that as the state law dictates.
So you've already formed an opinion that it's okay?
I've never been asked this question until today, so I don't think I've formed an opinion fully.
I believe you just said it was okay.
Separate those who are campaigning from any use of state funds or equipment during that process. It's individual citizens' responsibility and right to do so.
Okay, if we have a Department of Administration, which does the payroll, they set up a computer program that does the deductions, use state employees, and to help deliver campaign funds to an entity, do you think that could possibly be an abridgment of the Executive Budget Act?
Yes, it could possibly be. I'm not sure what the Act says. It has not come before us. And so if it was lawful and legal, and as state personnel had an opportunity to do so, if it was not against the law, then they should be able to use that as one of their rights. I wouldn't personally want to do it, but if it's their right, then it's their right.
Oh, okay, Dr. Hamilton. You're suggesting there might be ambiguity on this. Do you think the state maybe should look at that and maybe clarify it and give you better direction so we don't have to learn on the job whether or not it's unethical or whether we've been unwittingly using state funds to violate the Executive Budget Act?
If we've been using state funds unwittingly and have been doing that, it needs to be stopped.
Okay, so you...
Sure that that would be very advisable to dig into that further if that case is happening.
You think it might be advisable to just to remove some ambiguity and maybe clamp down on that a little bit, Dr. Hamilton?
I would be 100% willing to enforce that.
Well, thank you. That's all I have. Any other questions for Dr. Hamilton? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Dr. Hamilton, for being willing to serve in this area. We're going to go into a difficult time economically, which is going to put a lot of pressure on supervisors. To date, have you felt the pressure of supervisors thwarting the employees' access to your panel?
No, I have not felt that, Senator Coghill.
All I would say is I think with the pressure coming over the next couple of years, I would just keep a keen interest in that.
Thank you for advising us. Our next meeting will be in May.
Dr. Hamilton, I didn't have any other questions. Any members of the committee? Is there anybody from the public who wished to testify on Dr. Hamilton's reappointment? Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Hamilton, for your willingness to continue to serve and your very frank and direct answers, and I only asked you because you're the conduit here available during this confirmation hearing, and wish you good luck on the floor. I think it's probably clear sailing for you, sir.
Well, thank you very much. We'll see you all March. I'll be down end of this month to see everybody. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. And we'll similarly, we'll sign the report at the end with the same provisions. We have one more appointee, and that's Brandon Nakasato. And I probably get a correction on that name.
That was correct.
Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us you've been appointed, how you got to the point of being appointed. Were you solicited? Did you campaign for it? And what do you hope to do on the on this commission?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brandon Nakasato. I'm currently a research analyst with Senior and Disability Services within the Department of Health and Social Services. I actually applied for the Commission for Human Rights and was honored to get the governor's recommendation. I wanted to take the opportunity to tell you briefly about my background. After college, I served my first term as an AmeriCorps volunteer, where I helped settle Somali refugees into their new community in Lewiston, Auburn. While there, I also served on a all-volunteer local human rights organization, which was called the Lewiston-Auburn Community Task Force. This task force was a cooperative venture between the Maine Human Rights Commission, law enforcement, and other local authorities to review human rights complaints locally within Lewiston-Auburn. I wanted to let you know also that I've served on multiple boards of directors which were involved with anti-discrimination and human rights work. These included the African Immigrants Association, the African Immigrants Advocacy Group, and the Kentucky Fairness Alliance. And finally, my work as an employee liaison while working at UPS was where I helped to mediate labor complaints between management and hourly staff. Finally, I wanted to say that my commitment to human rights is based on my experience working on broad matters of social justice and my personal experience and perspective as a minority. I believe in the inherent equality and dignity of every person, and that the work of the Commission in its 53-year history is vital to ensuring it is honored as called for by our human rights law. I'm thankful for Governor Walker's appointment and humbled by the opportunity to serve our state in this capacity, and I'm thankful for you all considering this nomination. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Nakasato? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nakasaka. It's Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla. I see part of the function list real property. You know, in my estimation, when it comes to people and their property, it's one of the things that I hear quite often from, and I know that some of my other colleagues in the Senate, the same, where a average citizen, let's just say they're a victim of a crime, and their property is seized by virtue of that. And then they can't get it back. And months go by. In some cases, years go by. What's the solution to that? And I know it sounds like an interesting critter with the Commission on Human Rights, but I suppose we'd call that one of the human rights of your property and protection thereof.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, thank you for your question. It is my understanding that as a part of the mediation or the reconciliation process, we are empowered with the ability to make whole decisions. We're not allowed to make punitive judgments, but we are empowered with the ability to erase the damage of the violation and to make it as though it never happened. And so in your situation, what my understanding would be, and please correct me if I'm wrong because I'm still new to this, is that that would be returned to the person whose rights were violated under a particular part of the human rights law.
Yeah, so let's just take a hypothetical for a moment. I have a necklace, a gun, and a car that are stolen. How does a person reach you and the Human Rights Commission when they can't get their property back? What's the provision for that? I mean, how's the average person know that that's the recourse available?
Mr. Chair, Senator Huggins, as far as theft, I'm not sure that theft would be covered under the human rights law as a violation. But as far as the remediation process, just to explain that, we take most of our intake is through the phone and through in-person interviews. What happens then is that an intake person reviews the specifics of the case to determine whether it is applicable under the human rights law. If it's not, then the person is redirected to the applicable organization. And if it is, then it starts, you know, finding out whether there's substantial evidence to justify moving forward. If there isn't, to the best of my understanding, it means that the case is dismissed because there is not substantial evidence, and that can be, that dismissal can be appealed. If there is substantial evidence, then you move forward with a written compilation of the facts of the matter that is notarized by the complainant, and it is delivered to the respondent, to the alleged violator. And so most of the people come through phone and through in person. From what I've been told, we like to do it in person as that gives us more opportunity to flesh out more of the details and be sure that we're doing an accurate intake on the matter.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Nakasato, I was looking on the Human Rights Commission page in summary of recent cases, and some of them are pretty old, but I think there's some attempted humor here. Costly threats, cooking. These are how the cases are described. Cooking up a settlement, the language of mediation, driving a truck through discrimination, coming or going. I mean, they're all kind of little trite titles for, I guess, what those would call it serious work, either for the addressing the concerns of the person who feels aggrieved and then the employer who has to spend a lot of legal expenses defending against the charge. Two can be better. One, your kind can't work here. Not going to take it anymore. Dollars for dirty jobs. Yeah, it's a... I don't know if that's that goes for gallows humor over at the Civil Rights Commission or the Human Rights Commission, but what do you think about that?
Senator Stoltz, thank you for your question. That is interesting because I actually discussed this at the orientation with Executive Director Haley. We are, of course, bound by some pretty strict confidentiality rules. And so I guess that would be an attempt at gallows humor, and for the regular reader when they come to our page, to kind of, it's very serious reading, and so they just inject a little bit of levity. Of course, I think most of these are written by the commission staff, and I would be more than happy to direct your concerns to the staff on that matter.
Well, thank you, Mr. It was really a question when, you know, if an employer had written some of these things, they might be before your commission.
some of them, I have a sense of humor that is not always appreciated by my family. So when I read them, I thought they were amusing, and they kind of provided a different angle in looking at the cases. I've read through the cases for 2014. I have the last three or four annual reports, and it looks like it was just an innocent attempt at humor.
Well, that could be a defense of an employer too. Now just think about what. No.
And that's with the, of course, with the, when they're looking for substantial evidence, we're required, of course, to be impartial. And I think that's a part of the success of the commission is that it's been impressive. impressed on me, and I have been impressed in meeting the staff, that they take it very seriously, that they have to be impartial going into this and approach it in a professional manner, because they need the trust of both the respondent and the complainant in coming to a resolution. In fact, I think it's 7 out of every 10 cases are mediated before they reach a hearing. And for me, that's the successful part of the commission, is that they, even after this harm, this alleged harm, they're able to bring people back together and kind of re-heal what's broken.
Thank you. I have one other question, and Senator Huggins, because I had 4 or 5 meetings back over Saturday through various parts of my districts, and a couple people mentioned the issue of, I'll probably stumble over the terminology because I'm not quite as conversant as some of the folks in your shop, but transgender, transvestite, and access to same-sex bathrooms. And where do you view your responsibility at protecting human rights? Is it the broader class, or the rights of that individual? Whatever, and this is awkward even trying to explain it without having somebody say I'm violating the law. But it's a frustration of my constituents if people are one of those initials of LGBT. I'll say it that way, and wanting to use and it's usually it comes concerns from fathers of daughters, and mm-hmm. having men who anyway. I think you know the question.
Yes, Senator Stoltz, thank you for your question. Because I am new to, and I understand this is a quasi-judicial body, and it has been impressed on me that there are strict rules. And as far as I see it, we are enforcing the Human Rights Law, AS 1880. And that very clearly has 5 different areas where it is illegal to discriminate in, and that includes places of public accommodation, and it includes I believe 6 different classes that are covered, and then an additional 5 in some instances. Now, one of those is not gender identity. It of course may be covered under sex. But I can say that we have not received, as far as I know, any complaints submitted to the commission concerning access to bathrooms for transgender individuals. And should that case come up, of course, it will be investigated, I assume, like any other case, based on the facts at hand.
So could I invite parents who are concerned, maybe put on out if they're concerned about maybe be preemptive, could I have parents contact your office just to make sure they establish a beachhead there?
I think the commission is open to public comment. Of course, if we had any cases, we wouldn't be able to provide any information because of confidentiality rules. But I believe, to the best of my knowledge, that public comment is welcome on all matters.
Well, that gives us a good conduit. You're probably less likely to have an aware parent, so maybe we'll have to facilitate their ability to contact you, because the folks that want to assert a new right, I think, know right how to get to your front door. Thank you. Then another question that came up a couple of times during district hearings is the issue of Sharia law. And if you had a complainant who wanted to exercise that as a human right for their, and how do you balance that in its misogynistic, anti-woman, anti-gay, so many things of intolerance? I would just give us a hypothetical about how you would you have a practitioner of Sharia law who says he or she's been denied the right to exercise that.
I'm not familiar very much with Sharia law. I'm just not familiar with it very much, and where, besides it being practiced outside of a mosque, I'm not aware of it. And I've been looking through the cases, and I haven't seen any relating to the freedom of Muslims to practice Sharia law. And so I just don't have very much familiarity to be able to answer that hypothetical.
Again, we have another conduit. We can send folks that are concerned about it being applied over to your shop. So this has been very useful today. Any other questions for Mr. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Knox, out of Charlie Huggins, again from Wasilla. Under special facts under the State Commission for Human Rights, it says the Attorney General serves as a legal counsel. Is that true, or is it his representative?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, thank you. It could be a representative, and our current legal counsel in representing the Attorney General is Assistant Attorney General Bill Milks.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried about the Attorney General being overworked and us having to pay him overtime for his task he's got. Thank you.
And welcome, Senator McGuire.
Good morning.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Nakasato? So, thank you. Is there anybody from the public wishing to comment or testify on Mr. Nakasato's appointment to the Human Rights Commission by Governor Walker? That will close public testimony on his. So, at the end of the hearing, before we. We're going to forward the in accordance with AS 3905080, the State Affairs Committee will be reflected as having reviewed the following three names and the three public members we just and recommend the appointments be afforded forwarded to the joint session at a yet undetermined time and as always, this does not reflect the intent of anybody to vote for or against. It's just our review process. So thank you all three of you for being here this morning. We will stand at recess for just a moment and let Senator Coghill get ready. Senate State Affairs come back to order at 9:25. We've been really endeavoring to get the committee substitute before us, but it's a lot more complicated moving pieces, and we have our manager, my sleep-deprived staffer. As I think he worked all night. He didn't go to bed on Sunday night and was up till 1:30 last night. And it's the complexity of this legislation. This is not one we want to make a mistake on. And I'll talk to the members individually and see if there's a. Senator Coghill has two other committees to go through on this one, and it still has. We still have to go through the other side of the legislative process, and I haven't seen as much work on the other side as has been going on here. So we want to get the bill out of committee, but we want to also make sure that it reflects the best bill we can put out or something. Or we have different levels of tolerance thresholds. Some people, and for me, it'll be. I have still some concerns. It'll be what I can best tolerate. And that's not meant pejoratively, being a cynic, constructive cynic, I hope. So I'll just leave any comments for Senator Coghill. If we have any state officials here that wanted to comment about ongoing concerns after Senator Coghill is done. I'll certainly invite folks to come up to make any general or specific comments. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comments would be general. First of all, thanks to you and your staff. We took some amendments and put them out last week that dealt with many of the questions that the Office of Victims' Rights had brought forward. We brought one new concept into those amendments, and that was for those who had been convicted of a drug offense, that they would have to go through drug testings in order to retain their welfare. That was one kind of safety measure in trying to move forward. But to be fair, we had I think our amendments were like nearly 18 pages in length, and dealt with probably 7 of the 9 codes that we were dealing with. So they're on basis. They dealt with really the cornerstone issue that this committee has dealt with, and that is domestic violence, sexual assault awareness, and the victim's rights to know what's going on, to do some of the safety issues that I thought were important to do. And so just on the broad part of that was the commission looked at them at a high level. It was consensus-driven. And by the time we got them drafted into the actual statutory provisions, there was some incongruencies that had to be ironed out and some protections that maybe had to be narrowed down a little bit. And to be fair, the commission had a charge to look at the most cost savings as well as the best public safety. And they did the best they could, but by the time it got into statutory provisions, whether it was the way we handled misdemeanors or the way we handled probation parole, I think the amendments dealt with some of those issues fairly well. As it goes into the Judiciary Committee, I think we'll see even more. But to be fair, we don't have a document in front of us, and it's very difficult for me to explain in detail, because I can't point to a page and line number, which I'd much rather do. To your credit, Mr. Chairman, I think your staffer was working way into early this morning, even trying to get those things drafted, which means now I have people over in legislative legal, tooling away. They deal with substantive issues, but they also deal with applicability laws, court rules, and implementation timelines. So to make sure that those all got pushed in correctly, I would much rather go through in detail to show page and line number where the changes are, and then the policy calls that weren't dramatically changed in this, Mr. Chairman. I think that would be probably the better thing to do. Okay. And so that would give me between now and Thursday to highlight those things. The only thing that I can commit to the committee and to those who are interested is as soon as I have a document available, I will have it in your offices so that and it has to come from you.
Yeah, we're going to distribute it right away, yeah. And that's because this is you're also our fact-checking committee. Right. That's what we used to do with the capital budget, distribute it, and that was our review committee.
And it would be my expectation, Mr. Chairman, that we get a chance to go through it on Thursday.
And Is anybody, is, are folks going to be in town over the weekend? No.
I will be.
Okay.
But one thing I was going to put on the record, Mr. Chairman, is three of us are in the Judiciary Committee, so that, that makes it somewhat nice in the sense that for however slow this process is taking, once we get to Judiciary, you've got three of us at least pretty tuned up on it.
And for those watching, the Chairman has had to put up with my petulance in trying to push this thing along. So.
I've had to. Now folks think that we're not dealing with fiscal issues anymore, but this has got a tighter timeline than our, than the others that are all being worked on concurrently in both bodies on the various fiscal plans. So those are, I've appreciated Senator McGuire's understanding. We've put off the her issue, and the governor's office is a little more anxious, but this has a tighter deadline for review than the other does, and we know we're going to, that work is being done throughout the building. I, something about the House isn't doing anything except for, I heard something about that, I appreciate I have some talented multitaskers at this table and throughout the rest of the 19.
Mr. Chairman, and I can say this, the House is watching what we're doing in this committee probably pretty intensely, and they're looking forward to the document that comes out. I think you'll see a willingness to take some of the work that we've done to heart.
I see some House staffers in here. So. With that, I apologize. Is there anybody from any of the departments that have had involvement with this that wanted to make any comments or expression your hopes, aspirations? Please continue to talk to my office, and as we're I don't think these are anybody's hopes or aspirations. These are grueling work that they all these hardworking state employees are engaged with.
And for the public watching, Mr. Chairman, we're dealing with almost 11 codes and court rules that are it's a massive undertaking. So my impatience is only that we get to the meat of the issue, but at the same time, it just takes time to work these things out. I appreciate that.
And Mr. George, did Mr. Steiner's document get distributed? Well, that should be distributed to members. He had critiques of the Office of Victims' Rights, and I asked him about that during the Department of Administration budget hearings, and it was acknowledged he has a different constituency than the than victims. He is representing the accused and certainly has a different perspective, and while I respect his points of view, I think we had the appropriate person outlining victims' rights. That's really not the forte of a public defender is watching out for the rights of victims. Matter of fact, many times it's they're supposed to just destroy their credibility and dignity and violate every constitutional precept that the Constitution has. And I'm not saying that. I am. Yeah. And there's some lawyers chuckling back there. So I'll just leave that. But I do want to make sure that document gets distributed. He is doesn't believe our career prosecutor or victims advocate really understands victims' rights as well as he does, but I respectfully disagree, but you can make your own decisions.
Mr. Chairman, just on constitutional issues, I think people need to know that we actually have a constitutional amendment, I mean a constitutional provision that deals with victims' rights. We also have constitutional issues with regard to our correction system. It's a punitive and correction system that has some requirements. And we're trying to balance those as best we can with individual rights and liberties being paramount in the Constitution as well. We certainly don't want people who are charged with one thing being penalized with something inappropriate. And I think that's something that I watch out for, too. So it's the balance of constitutional requirements that we're trying to work here. And I think it's going well. It's going slower than I like, but it's going well.
With that... That's as Martin Basalm said, if it doesn't gel, it's not an aspect. That was from Psycho, 1960. With that, we will stand in adjournment next time. We should have, I believe, the whole day on Thursday is your day, and we will try to send this on the way. I'm certainly not in love with the subject matter, but it's work that we have to do, and we will endeavor to do our part and do it as quickly as we can. With that, we'll stand in adjournment.